before he killed them, that he moved their stuff around to make them think they were losing their minds. The man she'd overheard swore that he'd gotten the information from a county deputy, though there hadn't been any mention of it in the news. Her second thought was much more realistic. Mom's been guilt-cleaning again. Katie usually cleaned, because her mother worked nights and took care of the twins during the day. Her off days were for catching up on sleep. But as Katie pushed the toys onto the bath mat and stretched for the tampon box, she noticed dust inside the cabinet. Mom cleaned, but she couldn't even do it right, Katie groaned. Her mom claimed that Katie had obsessive-compulsive disorder. As a nurse who'd spent her early years working in psychiatric units, she was always diagnosing everyone. Outwardly, Katie denied it. Inwardly, she knew it was true. Katie worked long hours, too. School and the twins' bedtime routine, in addition to college applications, student loan applications, extracurriculars, and volunteering at the hospital, all the while worrying that she still wasn't doing enough to get out of Osborne. Ritualistic cleaning and straightening and checking and organizing made her feel calmer in a world that was out of her control. 6 years ago, everything had blown up when her dad stormed out only a few weeks after the twins were born. Antisocial personality disorder, her mom had diagnosed. Katie refused to go back to the way things had been. As she moved everything back to its correct location, her eyes snagged on a fresh droplet of blood. It was on the alligator-shaped bath mat near the toilet, and it was her own. Katie swore under her breath. She blotted it with a tissue and scoured it with cold water. There was a thunk downstairs.
"Hey!" she yelled. "What was that?"
"We don't know," the twins said.
"What did you guys do?"
"Nothing."
Katie sighed, sure. She changed into her pajamas and hustled toward them. 90 minutes later, she tucked their warm, sleepy bodies into bed. She turned on their matching nightlights, closed their door, and sighed again. Time was hers at last. She headed back downstairs to work on an essay for the University of Southern California. All the universities she was applying for required a flight, or at least a lengthy car trip, to get there. She loved her family, but she'd love them more with distance. Night had spread its bat-like wings. Katie turned on the porch lights and the overhead light in the kitchen, where her work was laid out across the table. As she reflected on a time or incident when she'd experienced failure, tonight's essay topic, it took all her willpower not to check the news. She wished that she could have walked to the school with everybody else, even Zachary, who smelled like stale cigarettes and unwashed clothing, who'd never given a crap about his grades and pretended not to give a crap about anyone, was in attendance. Katie suspected that he actually cared about other people a lot, but he hadn't had enough people in his life who cared about him. Despite Zachary's abrasiveness, she had a soft spot for him. He was smart, and if he applied himself, he could go on to do great things. It was frustrating to know that he probably wouldn't. Most likely, he'd drop out and get a job on the floor at Nance, the town's only manufacturer. It built machinery for food processing plants. Or maybe he'd become a day laborer, detasseling corn and castrating piglets. Either way, it was unlikely that he would ever leave Osborne. There was a creak on the basement stairs. Katie's heart juddered as she whirled around in her seat. Beside her, the refrigerator hummed and the dishwasher sloshed. Above her, the twins' white noise machine whirred, but below her, the basement remained silent. She picked up her phone, ears pricked, but set it down after another minute. "It's just the house," She tried to refocus on the essay. She read her last sentence 5 times, but she couldn't shake a feeling. Katie stared at the basement door. Another creak. She jumped up, the wooden chair leg scraping against the floor. Her pulse beat violently as she grabbed her phone and dialed 911. Connecting, her phone said. Connecting, connecting. Heavy footsteps pounded up the stairs. Katie's senses exploded with terror as she threw herself against the door, which could only be locked from the other side. At the same instant, another body landed against it full force, just enough to open it. They struggled. Open. Shut. Open. An arm and shoulder wedged through, and a knife slashed toward her body. Katie pushed the door against the arm with all her strength. The arm flailed. There was another weighty thrust, and her side gave way. She fell, and her phone slipped from her grasp. It skidded across the floor as David Thurston Ware burst into the kitchen. He was wearing jeans and a Lion Pride sweatshirt. They were splattered with turquoise paint, the same color that her mother had meant to repaint the kitchen chairs last spring, the same color that Katie had propped against the basement window that evening. She took all this in an instant, as she scrambled to her feet. He lunged for her. She ran toward the butcher block, reaching for the biggest knife as he stabbed her in the shoulder. When he yanked it out, she kicked him. David shoved her against the cabinets. His hands smeared her skin with red and turquoise. She was 5'10", and so was he. Their weight was similar, and the same amount of adrenaline coursed through their bodies. But he was the one with the weapon. Katie kneed him in the balls as David stabbed her in the upper right abdomen. They both buckled over. The knife pushed deeper into her liver. She collapsed, frightened and crying, but oddly hushed. David peered over her. His question was curious, though his voice was dead.
"Why aren't you screaming?"
"Because I don't want to wake up my brother and sister." When she didn't answer out loud, he finished her off. He didn't have time to wait. He checked her phone, which was still trying to connect to the police. David ended the call. The cops already knew he was in the area, and he was angry. He didn't like having to rush. He sawed through the rib cage, stomping on the knife to help crack the bones faster, and ripped out the heart. He slammed it on top of the glossy college brochures that had been stacked on the table for months, because Katie's heart had been set on college. He was funny. Nobody seemed to get that. Lights flashed outside the kitchen window, red and blue, one street over. He tugged off the sweatshirt. It wasn't camouflage, but it had acted as camouflage. Nearly everyone on the street today had been wearing school colors. He threw it as he ran, and it landed on Katie, the Katie husk, crumpled on the floor. No longer of use. Chapter 24 Makani and Ali had waited, terrified, in the cereal aisle until Officer Bev had escorted them out. Chris had tried to chase after David, but he'd already disappeared. Makani and Ali were interviewed and gave statements again. Now it was late, and they were back at the Larson house, decompressing at the kitchen table and attempting to excise the horrendous image of Caleb's grotesque prayer from their minds. Chris was on the phone in the next room. Ali stared vacantly at the oven.
"Maybe we should have chased him," he said. "Maybe we could have caught him."
Makani's knees were up in the chair. Her non-bandaged arm was wrapped around them, and her head was tucked down. She felt too broken to lift it.
"He killed Caleb," he said. "Not Zachary."
His words hung limply in the air between them. Out in the fields, the nighttime insects whirred and buzzed. The wind chimes on the front porch sang 3 notes.
"I don't think this is about bullying," he said.
She shook her head, but it was in agreement.
So what the hell is it about?
It scared her to admit that she had no idea. She hadn't realized that she'd taken a measure of comfort in at least knowing why she'd been attacked. There'd been a reason. Not knowing David's motivation felt like everybody she knew was in danger again. A shadow fell over them as Chris stepped back into the light of the room. His face was white with disbelief.
There's been another one.
The midnight sky wept in an unexpected drizzle. Chris moved his laptop, binders, metal ticketing notebooks, and food containers into the trunk of his car. Makani darted into the emptied passenger seat, and Ali slid into the back. In the rear-view mirror, his face was printed with diamond-shaped shadows from the metal dividing grate. They'd been at the house for less than 30 minutes. Chris had to return to work, so he was driving them to the hospital to stay with Grandma Young. He refused to leave them alone. Makani felt so exhausted that she wanted to cry, but she didn't want to be left alone either. As the endless rows of corn stalks rolled past her window, long corridors into murky blackness, she shivered with the unshakable feeling that David could be anywhere. Her lower legs pressed against the bulletproof vest resting on the floorboards. Chris noticed her shivering and turned up the heat. The windshield wipers swiped at a slow and steady pace.
"She texted me this morning," Makani said, remembering.
He glanced at her sharply. "Katie contacted you? About what?"
"She said she was sorry to hear what had happened to me, and she was there if I wanted to talk."
Another deadening inside Makani.
"I didn't text her back."
"Did you talk to her often? Was she a close friend?"
"We weren't friends at all."
"We were friendly. Sometimes we talked in class, but we never texted or hung out or anything."
Chris frowned.
"So why start texting you this morning?"
"That's just Katie being Katie." From the back seat, Ali dismissed the notion of there being anything odd or sinister behind it. She was nice to everyone.
"Who found her?" Makani asked. They already knew how she'd been found.
"Her mom."
It seemed hard for Chris to say it.
"Apparently, she works the late shift at the hospital. And Katie wasn't answering her phone, so she came home on her break to check in. Katie's younger brother and sister were still asleep upstairs."
Makani used to shave her arms for diving. Now her arm hair stood on end as she remembered a laminated ID badge, Kurtzman, the kind-hearted nurse who'd given her blueberry yogurt and watched over her, was Katie's mother.
"She couldn't have known."
Chris sounded shaken. Maybe he was picturing himself in her place.
"I doubt that she actually expected to find something wrong."
The rain ticked staccato against the roof of the car. Perhaps sensing that his brother needed to think about something else, Ali asked him to repeat his knowledge of David's whereabouts. After attacking them yesterday at Makani's house, David had traveled upriver instead of down, which the police hadn't predicted. Under the cover of night, he'd crept back into town and hidden inside the back room at Greeley's, correctly guessing that everyone would be searching for him out in the countryside. He'd been right under their noses the whole time. At first, the police were flummoxed as to how he'd broken in, because none of the doors or windows had been damaged. But then Caleb's uncle, the owner, recalled having to cut a new key for Caleb a few months back. His uncle had found this odd because Caleb wasn't usually forgetful or careless. The police speculated that David had stolen the key and entered the store as if he belonged there. It probably wasn't the first time that he'd broken in, and the key probably wasn't the only thing he'd stolen. Several members of the marching band, including Alex,
reported that Caleb had practiced his speech inside the store, and then when he returned from delivering it to the crowd, he'd claimed that his hat plume was missing. It seemed possible that David had stolen it while Caleb was practicing and then used it to lure him back.
It's still not clear why he didn't kill Caleb before the memorial, Chris said, keeping his eyes on the two-lane road. Maybe because people would have looked for Caleb sooner? And we also don't know.
But he cut himself off, with a glance in the rearview mirror at his brother.
Know what? Ollie asked.
Chris looked like he didn't want to answer.
We also don't know if David had more than one target inside the store.
Ollie's tense expression showed McConney that the thought had already crossed his mind.
We do know that he stole a sweatshirt, Chris said, trying to hurry past it, which he left behind at Katie's before jacking her 2011 Ford Fiesta. The sweatshirt was covered in blood and paint from her basement. We don't know what he's wearing now. We still haven't found his hoodie, and no one noticed him leave her neighborhood. Everyone was looking for someone on foot.
So he's leaving town. McConney wasn't sure if she believed it, and even if it were true, it wasn't what she wanted. She wanted to know exactly where David was. Until he was captured, she would never feel at ease again. A pair of headlights loomed through the rain in the distance.
What color was the car?
Ollie asked.
Blue. Chris said quietly.
The headlights grew closer. McConney's heartbeat spiked, and Chris's grip tightened on the steering wheel. It was impossible to tell anything about the car except that it was small. Everyone held their breath until the car passed. Red. A Ford Focus. They exhaled. A minute later, there was a new pair of headlights, and their lungs tightened again. And then released. Tightened. Released. It was like that for the remainder of the drive. Grandma Young was asleep, heavily sedated. McConney and Ollie tried to sleep too, taking turns on the comfortable recliner, but their brains were wired. As the night droned on, they watched the cars in the parking lot below and stared at the flickering television screen. It wasn't a heavy storm, but it was enough to mess with the signal. The TV was set on the lowest volume above mute. For hours, CNN cycled between an airstrike in Syria, a group of missing hikers in North Carolina, and the latest murders in Osborne. Caleb Randolph Greeley, Jr. Katie Teresa Kurtzman. Their full names were spoken aloud by strangers. The same atrocious clips of the same panicked citizens were replayed. The victims were turning into numbers, statistics that were being used to compare David with other notable serial killers. He'd obliterated two people within a 3-hour gap and with a crowd nearby. It wasn't just McConney. The entire Midwest had the crawling sensation that he was standing right behind them. But here, inside the hospital, it was even worse. Katie and her mom were the subject of every low-spoken conversation. It was impossible not to overhear the muffled crying coming from the nurse's station, the choked sobs, the noses blowing into tissues. It was nearly daybreak before the talking heads had something to report.
"Breaking news in the hunt for the Osborne Slayer," a woman's voice said.
McConney's and Ollie's bleary eyes sprang open as the Latina news anchor continued.
"You're looking at footage from a truck stop near Boys Town, Nebraska, just outside of Omaha, at 11 o'clock last night. An unidentified driver called 911 after spotting a blue Ford Fiesta ditched on an embankment near the truck stop. When the police pulled the surveillance video, this is what they discovered."
Black and white footage showed a figure in a long coat walk up to a semi and speak to the driver through the window. Even though the outdated cameras made his movements jerky and pixelated, McConney could tell that the grainy figure was David. A nauseated chill washed over her. David climbed inside the truck, and it drove away. "As you can see," the news anchor said, "the truck makes a right turn before traveling out of frame. It looks like the driver is headed back toward Osborne." McConney glanced at Ollie. His face was a perfect reflection of her fear. "At this time, the police have not revealed the driver's name, only that his tags were from Indiana. It is not yet known if he was aware of the hitchhiker's identity." That was it. The news rehashed the story from the top. David kept climbing into the truck, and it kept making a right turn. The killer kept going home. Chapter 25. It was the eve of All Hallows' Eve. The rain had stopped, but the asphalt was still slick with water and oil. A lurid sunrise, worthy of Hawaii, illuminated the sky. It was such an obscene contrast to the overhanging dread that it felt like they were being mocked. McConney and Ollie had slipped away from Grandma Young before she'd even known that they were there. Chris drove them back to the Larson house. This time, McConney sat beside Ollie in the back seat. Their fingers were icicles as they grasped each other with all four hands. Despite the ideal opportunity to escape, David had chosen to come home. He tried to kill her and failed. What if he was returning to finish the job?
"The truck driver was stopped just past Norfolk at 12:45 a.m., Chris said, filling in some of the blanks. "Must have been the only person in America who hadn't heard about the manhunt. He claimed that he only listens to Christian talk radio, and they've been yammering about the new Supreme Court justice all week. He told the deputy that David was quiet and polite. He also said it looked like he was wearing a woman's coat."
Despite seeing it in the surveillance footage, this last detail startled McConney.
"My guess," Chris said, "is that he's still wearing the same blood-stained jeans and hoodie, and he needed something to cover them up. The coat probably belongs to Katie's mom. The driver said he dropped him off in front of a farm near Troy."
Troy was only one town over. Alex lived on a ranch just outside it.
"David told him it was his parents' farm. We've already interviewed the farmers, but they were asleep. They didn't see or hear anything unusual. The other neighbors are being interviewed now, and there's a team searching the surrounding fields."
McConney and Ollie tightened their icy grips. There was nothing else they could do. The cold autumn air crackled throughout the countryside, electric with anticipation. McConney and Ollie were bundled inside sleeping bags on Chris's hardwood floor. Heat whirred out from the registers. With the daylight, locked door, and armed police officer, McConney's body finally succumbed to rest. Her dreams began heavy and empty, but over the course of the afternoon they struggled into existence. A sharp knife in one hand, a severed ponytail in the other, a hooded figure lurching out from behind a grandfather clock. She would fight these nightmares for the rest of her life. While the trio slept, strangers streamed in from out of town. Even more media, but also armchair detectives, online sleuths, some well-meaning and some not, jumping into ambitious action, as well as morbid gawkers, deceitful psychics, and drunk college kids who thought it'd be a hoot to visit the famous corn maze. The displaced Sweeney Todd cast and crew had turned it into a haunted corn maze, and the Martin family would donate the weekend's profits to the victims' families.
"Knowing he's still out there just makes the maze a lot scarier," a student wearing a scarlet ball cap with a cream end said, speaking to a field reporter. His fraternity brothers whooped behind him on camera. Plus, you know, charity.
Even the National Guard rolled in. They were to stand watch over the football game so that the townspeople would feel brave enough to attend. There were no parking spaces left at the school. The tailgate party had started early. The playoffs didn't stop for tornado sirens, and they weren't about to stop for a serial killer. And through it all, Makani, Ollie, and Chris slept. Chris's phone rang when the sun was low on the horizon. Makani scrambled up to a sitting position against his bed, her bulging eyes on the door. It was still closed.
Yeah, Chris said into the phone.
Ollie scooched out from his sleeping bag to hunker down with Makani. He was careful not to sit on the side of her injured arm.
Shit, Chris sighed. Okay, yeah. See you soon.
Makani burrowed into the shelter of Ollie's body as the phone thumped onto the bed above them. Chris released another sigh.
What is it?
Ollie asked.
Nothing. Nothing new, Chris clarified. Just shouldn't have slept so late. You need to go in? Yeah.
His feet swung over the edge of the bed beside Ollie.
So, I've got to head toward Troy, which is in the opposite direction of where you need to go. We'll take separate cars, but we'll leave at the same time. You guys are to drive straight to the hospital, okay? And you're to stay there until I tell you to leave.
Makani and Ollie nodded.
I'm going to check the house, just to be safe.
Chris stood, picking up his gun from the nightstand.
I'll be right back. Wait here.
In the doorway, he glanced back at them.
Do you have your phones?
Their phones were already in their hands. They held them up. Chris vanished down the hall. Ollie's under-eye circles were so dark that it looked like he'd been punched. Makani wished that she could touch his skin and heal it.
You okay?
He asked. No. Are you?
No.
But he smiled, which made her exhale a faint laugh. Chris's bedroom was as disheveled as Ollie's. Bags from Sonic and the gas station were scattered everywhere, and heaps of clothing were piled in front of the closet. The clothes looked clean, though permanently unfolded. The only vestiges of his youth appeared to be the three dusty guitars hanging on the wall, one acoustic, two electric. Beneath them was an amp covered in coffee cups and mail. The upstairs floorboards creaked as Chris moved from room to room. Makani's gaze snapped back to the door. This is so messed up.
The most messed up,
Ollie said. She held her breath as the footsteps continued toward the bathroom.
I mean, he said, I slept beside you all day and didn't think about sex once.
Her head remained locked, but her eyes swiveled toward him. He grinned.
That was a lie.
The wooden stairs groaned as Chris crept down them. Makani shook her head, but she was smiling slightly. Their ears strained. They waited. Suddenly, a yell rang out, followed by a loud crash. Makani gasped and shrank as Ollie clung to her in horror. There was the indistinct sound of things settling to the floor.
Squidward! Chris said. Fuck! You scared me.
Ollie pried his body off hers, embarrassed, though she sensed he'd been more scared for his brother than himself. She wondered if he was afraid every time Chris left for work. That must be tough. A few seconds later, Chris returned.
Sorry about that.
He seemed embarrassed, too.
We're good. We leave in 15 minutes, okay?
15. The number surprised Makani. Clearly, they weren't used to having a girl around. She hurried to wash her face and change clothes and realized, as the brothers were both ready and under 10, that the number had actually been inflated for her sake.
Ollie handed her a steaming Pop-Tart as she slid into his car. She practically swallowed it whole. When they hit the highway, they parted from Chris.
What the?
Ollie said under his breath. Makani looked up from checking her texts. The opposite lane of traffic was at a standstill. Dirty cars and trucks and RVs were backed up as far as she could see as a lone, red-headed employee with a flag waved them into the parking lot for the corn maze.
"Is it always this busy on a Friday night?" she asked.
"Never," Ollie said.
Vehicle after vehicle was packed with college-aged kids, voices hollering, music thumping, windows rolled down despite the frigid temperature. Makani stared at them with open displeasure, though not with disbelief. She'd lived through too much to feel disbelief.
People are sick. They think this is all a game.
On the other side of the maze, one of Ollie's neighbors was trying to turn out of their driveway.
"That's gonna take a while," he said.
Makani texted her friends with an update and told them where she was going. It was important to know where everyone was right now. Darby was at home, and Alex was at school with the band. But as soon as Makani's message disappeared, her phone vibrated with a response from Alex.
"I'm freaking out."
Makani frowned as she texted, question mark, question mark, question mark.
"Too many people here. Too crowded. Can't breathe.
Can your parents come back and pick you up?"
"They think it's safer in a crowd. I reminded them about Caleb and the memorial, but they weren't having it. I'm freaking out. I'm totally freaking out."
Ollie watched her from the corner of his eye. "What's going on?"
"Alex, I think she's having a panic attack."
"He was a quarter mile from my house last night. Now it feels like he's here. I can't do this. I seriously cannot do this."
"Does she need us to come get her?" Ollie asked as another text appeared from Alex.
"Could you come get me?"
"On our way," Makani said. Emoji heart.
"Hurry,"
Alex said. Emoji scream. The stadium was packed, and the wind carried the cheers and marching band and commotion all the way to downtown Osborne. As their car raced past Walnut Street, Makani looked toward her grandmother's house. It was just out of sight. The bright lights of the football field pierced through the dusk. Alex was waiting for them at the front gate. The whole area was packed, but she stood alone. Ollie unlocked the doors, rolled down his window, and waved to her. The aroma of cheap chocolate invaded the car. Tomorrow's trick-or-treating had been canceled, and word had spread to bring candy to the game. Costumed children dashed through the madness, collecting treats in their pillowcases and plastic orange pumpkins. Teenagers and adults had been banned from wearing costumes, in fear that David might hide among them, so they were decked out in scarlet and gold instead. The home crowd was so huge that it had spilled onto the visitors' side. The cheerleaders were leading them in the Lion Roar, a school spirit chant, and a powerful stampede of feet pounded and rumbled against the metal bleachers. Two members of the National Guard were visible just behind the main chain-link fence. They were dressed in fatigues and carrying assault rifles. They were supposed to make everyone feel protected, but Makani felt a nervous, unpleasant shudder. Alex flew into the back seat with her trumpet. Her plume caught on the doorframe and knocked the hat sideways.
Ow!
She undid the chin strap and ripped off the hat. She glared at the plume, or maybe she was scared of it.
"Are you okay?"
Makani asked. It was a dumb question. Alex slammed the door closed.
"Go!"
"Won't you get in trouble for leaving?" Ollie asked.
"Fuck that," Alex said. "Fuck all this.
I can't play a peppy fight song and pretend that you guys weren't almost murdered. I can't pretend that my crush and my section leader and three of my other classmates weren't actually murdered. And I can't pretend that the loser who did it isn't still out there. That was enough for Ollie. He pulled away from the curb. Makani unbuckled her seatbelt and crawled over the console into the back seat, where Alex was fumbling to unzip her red uniform. Makani helped her with the hidden buttons, which Alex had forgotten about, and then out of the jacket. Alex shook it away on the verge of tears. As Makani dug through her pockets for tissues, her phone rang. Darby had skipped straight past texting. "Is everything okay?" Makani asked. "Put him on speakerphone," Alex said.
"I'm fine," Darby said.
Makani pressed the button and his voice filled the car.
"I'm only calling because I'm driving." "That's still unsafe," Ollie said, and then he winced for being the square.
Makani wondered if his reaction was triggered by too many car crash stories from Chris, or maybe any type of accident reminded him of his parents. She still wasn't wearing a seatbelt, so she strapped in and motioned for Alex to do the same.
"I know, but I just got your texts," Darby said. "My signal was on the fritz from all these damn tourists. Is Alex with you?"
"I'm here," Alex said. "Where are you?"
"I was coming to get you. I'm passing the Dollar General right now."
"We're almost to the hospital," Makani said. "Meet us in the parking lot?" Darby's hatchback pulled up beside them less than 5 minutes later. Darby's and Alex's doors flew open, and they ran into each other's arms. They hugged for days. Makani crawled back into the passenger's seat and rubbed her hands in front of the vents. Ollie turned up the temperature. Darby and Alex popped into the vacated back seat. Darby was dressed in an old man tweed sport coat with actual elbow patches, and he was wearing a button-up and sweater underneath it for warmth. He snapped the suspenders of Alex's uniform.
"Did you guys see this? She's trying to steal my look." "Did you lock your car?" Ollie asked.
The question instantly brought the mood back down. Darby assured him,
"It's locked."
They fell into silence as they surveilled their surroundings. The parking lot was nearly empty. After several tense seconds, Makani said, "We're running out of time." No one challenged her. The apprehension in the car was suffocating. "I can't just sit here," she said. "He might be looking for me." Alex agreed. "He's killing faster and faster. And since everyone's looking for him, everyone not at the football game," she added darkly. "He probably feels like he has to finish his stupid plan, whatever it is, now, before he gets caught." "I wish we knew who else he's been gaslighting," Makani said. Ollie stared, unblinking, through the windshield.
"Haley, Matt, Rodrigo, you, Caleb, Katie. What's the real connection?"
"Clicks?"
Darby was hesitant. "None of you hung out together, but you all had a unique social group." "Maybe David felt alone, like he didn't belong to any group."
"Except he did," Alex said.
Darby shrugged. "I know, but I don't know. It seems like there's something there. So far, he's singled out one person from every group."
"I still think he's targeting the most talented students," Alex said, "or ambitious, or maybe even just the people who stand out. Maybe you all make him feel inferior and invisible, and this is his way of becoming more visible." When no one disagreed, Alex pressed on. "Who else seems exceptional? Who else is out there standing in front of crowds or making headlines or winning competitions?"
"Shit," Ollie said quietly.
His expression turned grave.
Do you remember the day when there was hardly anyone at school but us?
He was still staring ahead, but Makani knew the question was for her. You mean Wednesday? 2 days ago? The day we were attacked? This realization seemed to stun him. During periods of trauma, time could be funny like that. He tried to shake it off.
Right, but do you remember that bad joke I made? Stanton told us over the announcements that Rosemarie Holt had won a barrel race, and then I said that she should watch out?
Makani touched her lips in fear at the memory, clapping with the other students, so grateful for any small piece of good news. Darby shifted uneasily.
Rosemarie's been winning those events for a long time. Years, Ollie said.
Oh, God. Alex looked like she might throw up. What do we do? Chris answered after the first ring. Ollie repeated their theory but was quickly cut off. His brow furrowed as he listened.
Yeah, we're fine, he said. Yeah, okay.
Ollie stared at his phone. He hung up. What is it? Makani asked. What is it now?
They received a call from another trucker who picked up David. The guy just saw him on the news and recognized him. This new driver said he must have picked up David not long after the first driver dropped him off, and Chris said he knew the exact location. It was just stupid random luck that neither driver knew who he was.
Makani's heart plunged. What were the chances?
This guy claims to have dropped off David on the other side of Osborne. The police are headed there now. They think he's been snaking his way back to town through the fields. They think he might be headed to the stadium for a blitz attack.
Alex grabbed Makani's seat and shook it roughly. I knew it! Makani fixed a hand over Alex's to stop her. That doesn't sound like his M.O. Are you kidding? What would shake up this town more than an attack during the first game of the playoffs?
What did Chris say about Rosemarie? Darby asked.
Ollie frowned.
I think when Zachary wasn't a target, we lost any small sway we might have had. But someone needs to warn her, Darby said.
Ollie was already scrolling through his contacts. He caught Makani's look and explained.
Neighbor. Her family lives on the other side of the corn maze.
Of course. Everyone was connected to everyone in Osborne. Makani tamped down her ill-timed jealousy as the call went straight to voicemail.
Hey, it's Ollie Larson. Call me as soon as you get this. It's an emergency. Everyone's okay. Just call me back.
Makani stared at him, her eyes wide and frightened. What now? His voice hardened.
Seatbelts, everyone.
And then he turned the key in the ignition and pushed the pedal to the floor. Chapter 26 Moonlight gave a high-pitched whinny and pawed the fresh shavings. Shh! Rosemarie Holt stroked the brush in calming sweeps down the horse's sorrel neck. They're just a bunch of dumb rubberneckers. Nothing to be afraid of. Lights strobed and music howled. Screams of rowdy laughter erupted from the corn stalks, carrying to the stable at the edge of the Holt's property. Normally, it was a minor annoyance to live beside the tourist attraction. Tonight, however, the land was teeming with drunken rednecks, frat guys, and sorority girls, all out for a good scare. It was as if David Thurston Ware were a campfire urban legend and not an actual murderer at large. In the next stall, Cash stomped his feet with nervous agitation. The maze had never had lights or music at night before. I don't love it either, buddy, she grumbled, feeling a fresh flush of anger at Emmett for leaving her with the chores.
When they were children, they'd each been given an American quarter horse. Emmett had chosen one with a black coat, so he'd named him after the man in black. This turned out to be prophetic as it reflected the way he treated Cash, like an accessory to look cooler. Rosemary and their parents did most of the caretaking. Rosemary had always wanted a horse. When she was little, she'd never been interested in a book or movie unless it contained at least one. Moonlight had been named after her favorite fictional horse. Even though hers wasn't golden, she was a light brownish red. Nor did she have a white mane or tail. Hers were flaxen. Rosemary believed that she was just as loyal a friend as Alana's Moonlight had been to the lioness herself. Over the years, admittedly, Rosemary had outgrown the name, but she still remembered why it had mattered, what it had meant to her. "All right, girl." She touched the horse's rump as she walked around, so she'd know Rosemary was there, and then tossed the brush into a plastic bucket of grooming tools. "Almost done. I'll get your hay." Rosemary took down the cross ties and picked up the bucket. She closed the sliding door behind her and left the bucket to grab the pitchfork, which was inside one of the empty stalls. The stable smelled wonderfully familiar. Wood shavings, sweet feed, and old leather. Though it also held a pungent underpinning of ammonia. The urine scent was always stronger after mucking out the stalls, but it would fade within the hour. Her waterproof boots tread quietly over the rubber floor pavers. Rosemary and Moonlight were a good team. They started barrel racing when she was 8 and competing when she was 9. The Sloan County Championship Rodeo used a traditional 3-barrel cloverleaf pattern. The event was timed. And if the racer knocked over a barrel, there was a 5-second penalty. Some rodeos had hat fines, too, where they'd charge the racer $25 if her hat fell off. Moonlight rarely bumped a barrel, and Rosemary never lost her hat. Rosemary wasn't without injury, though. A year ago she'd broken her right arm when she slipped off while riding bareback. And only 2 months ago, her strap had broken when she was hanging upside down at a full-blown gallop while trick riding. It was the strangest thing. The strap wasn't even that old. She'd almost broken her neck. The accident shook her up, but it didn't stop her. She was competitive, headstrong, and faster than the other racers. She was ready to go national. As she strode into the dark stall, an ear-splitting scream from next door startled her. Rosemary waited. Yep, laughter. Her jaw clenched as she imagined Emmett as one of the laughing imbeciles. "Hope you're having a good time," she thought bitterly. He'd come home from UNL for the weekend. He was supposed to be here, helping her. But when he'd learned that some of his school friends had also driven into town, he ditched her to join them. Their parents were at the football game, supporting her cousin on the team. Rosemary reached for the pitchfork through the black shadow, but her hand only greeted air. Patting the rough, planked wall farther and farther into the stall, she finally fumbled against the handle in the far corner. She grabbed it and turned back toward the light. The bucket was gone. A confused moment, a dreadful heartbeat, and then her nostrils filled with an unfamiliar and unwelcome odor. It was the unwashed scent of another human being. The former cruiser tore out of Osborne, but as it hit the connecting highway, the car speeding ahead of them unexpectedly and drastically slowed down. McConaughey glanced at the speedometer. It was 5 under the posted limit.
"What the hell?" she yelled at the other car. "Go!"
Ollie's knuckles tightened on the steering wheel. "This happens all the time. People look in their rearview mirrors and they think I'm a cop." In the back seat, Darby tried to reach Rosemary, but the cell towers were still overloaded. The calls either went straight to voicemail or they wouldn't connect at all.
Ali swerved into the oncoming lane and stepped on it. They raced past the car, and he zipped back into the right lane. With every mile, his adherence to safety regulations was going increasingly out the window. Less than a minute later, it happened again. Makani and Alex moaned.
All the time,
Ali said, gritting his teeth and passing the second car. Another speedometer check, 30 over the limit. He caught Makani eyeing it.
No one's pulling me over tonight. They're all on the other side of town.
Makani liked that Ali was a careful driver. She respected it, but she was grateful that he felt the urgency of their current situation. She gave the road a grim smile. I'm not complaining. Rosemary knew that scents could be comforting, but this was the first time she'd ever smelled a scent that was frightening. The stench of rancid body odor was close, and it was male, and it didn't belong to her brother. A slender figure stepped out in front of her stall. His gait was calm and measured. He was dressed in a strange coat, and he was holding the grooming bucket. Rosemary's knees began to quake. David Thurston Ware set down the bucket. He didn't need it. He'd only brought it to show her that he was the one who'd moved it. He shrugged off the coat, which fell to the ground in a woolen puddle. He was wearing the hoodie that she'd heard about on the news. The camouflage was covered with splotchy brown stains that were darker than the fabric's pattern. Dried blood. The reveal was both unnecessary and terrifying. He removed his knife from a sheath on his belt. The blade glinted. Staring into the darkness of her stall, he kicked the plastic bucket, and the tools clanged together.
They wouldn't have helped you much.
He took a step forward,
but they would have been better than nothing.
Rosemary tightened her grip on the pitchfork and lunged. Traffic deadened into a complete stop. Hawaii was notorious for its impassable two-lane roads, and it wasn't uncommon to get stuck behind a sightseer driving 15 under. Yet Makani had never felt road rage more intensely than she did right now.
Her house is right there.
Ali gestured angrily at a plain one-story just before the corn maze. The house was set back some distance off the road. Darby and Alex reached for their seat belts.
We'll make a run for it, Alex said.
No!
Makani's rage turned into panic.
No splitting up. We stay together.
I agree, Ali said as the cruiser inched forward.
But we can't just sit here, Alex said. David could already be there.
Darby attempted to soothe her.
Most likely he's in town. It's probably okay.
Alex fumed.
Whose side are you on?
Ali craned his neck to see around the gridlock. A pickup passed, and then he sharply turned the wheel and accelerated into the oncoming lane. A semi was coming straight toward them. They screamed. The truck blew its horn. Ali drove straight into the ditch beside the road and kept driving. The truck flew by, and the other drivers laid on their horns, shouting obscenities, as the cruiser hurtled down the length of the ditch, kicking up dust clouds into the night sky. The car bumped and rattled and thumped and shook.
Oh, my God! Oh, my God! Oh, my God!
Makani and Darby said together as Alex shrieked, somewhere between pleasure and fear. They hit the Holt's driveway, which was a dirt road. The car settled into a quieter grind, roughening as they picked up speed. Makani pointed at a small building away from the main house. Its lights were on.
There, she said.
Hold on, Ali said,
an instructional warning as he veered into the pasture. Makani, Darby, and Alex screamed again.
There was a fucking road up there, Makani said.
Sorry,
Ali said, as the car barreled through the grass toward the stable.
I got caught up in the moment.
What are we doing? Darby yelled.
Alex shouted with the entire force of her lungs.
We'd better not be wrong about this.
Rosemarie didn't grow up in rodeos for nothing. She was tough. A farm girl. And she wasn't about to be killed by a pathetic boy with a stupid knife. David looked astonished by the pitchfork coming at him. He dodged, but he wasn't quick enough. The far tine gouged into his side. He cried out with shock and pain. Startled that she'd made contact, that her weapon had slid through a living human being, she pulled it out. His body squelched as it released its hold. He staggered backward.
"That's right,"
Rosemarie said. She kept shouting at him, but she didn't know what she was saying. It didn't feel like any of this was actually happening. David ran from the stable, clutching his bleeding left side. The horses were upset. They neighed and kicked the walls as she raced through her options. She could wait for a signal and call the police, or she could make sure that David wouldn't come back to kill her first. Rosemarie gripped the pitchfork's handle so tightly that she felt bruises forming. She took a cautious step forward, another, and another. As she reached the stable door, a hand shot out and grabbed the pitchfork right above her hand. She cried out as she struggled to regain control. David pulled her toward the ground. For some reason, he'd set down his knife to seize the pitchfork, and now he was trying to pick it back up. Like hell he would. Rosemarie wrenched the pitchfork from his grasp, and that's when she became aware of a pair of headlights and a car thundering straight toward them. They were both stunned, but David recovered first. He snatched up the knife and swiped. The blade sliced into the flesh of her right thigh. She whacked him on the back with the pitchfork. She saw him double over, and then there was a blinding white light. And then she couldn't see anything. Chapter 27. The spotlight from Ollie's cruiser sliced a blazing hole through the black landscape. Only a few feet in front of them, Rosemarie and David were hunched over. Their frames were locked together, knotted in a struggle.
"I changed my mind! I changed my mind!" Alex said. "I wish we'd been wrong."
Makani threw open her door and bolted through the icy air and muddy grass. The other three doors flung open behind her. David twisted his body behind Rosemarie's, securing an arm around her neck, his knife aimed for her throat. It was coated with a liquid shadow of fresh blood. Rosemarie's round face looked pinched and paralyzed. Makani saw the whites of her eyes like a spooked horse. Her long, straight hair leaned to one side as she held all her weight on a single leg. She clutched at the other. Everything happened in an instant. Alex screamed toward David. He turned in the direction of her caterwaul, angling Rosemarie toward her and leaving his back to Makani. Makani jumped on him. Everyone toppled to the ground and Rosemarie cried out. Arms and legs and torsos tangled, and other hands were prying them apart, but Makani couldn't tell whose hands were friendly and whose were his. Another cry shredded the night. David wriggled out from the pile. His head turned back to them and his eyes flashed as he recognized Makani. She was trapped, and he was right there. But he was outnumbered, so he ran. Rosemarie was curled up like a fallen leaf. Makani touched an unmoving shoulder, bracing for the worst, and then the girl looked up.
"Oh, my God. Oh, thank God."
Makani began to weep.
"Are you okay?"
"Just this leg. It hurts to move."
Rosemarie seemed a little dazed, but she gestured to the gash in her thigh.
"How did you know?"
Darby dropped to his knees with a strangled sound. At first, Makani thought he'd been injured, but he was looking at Alex. Makani crawled forward.
"No. Please. No."
It was starting to snow.
Or maybe it had been snowing this whole time. Makani suddenly felt the cold wetness against her cheeks.